It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio. Carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmack13.com. At the same site are links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too. The listeners to the show who wish to join the conversation may call in 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold the calls until the end of the show, unless anything is relevant to what we're talking about at that moment. My 15-minute story and opinion show, John Mack Radio Rants, may also be accessed by going to my website. Once again, www.johnmack13.com, and clicking on the John Mack Radio Rants tab of shows. Unlike this show, the new show has no regular schedule, but is produced as a spirit movement. My guest next week on this show is writer and educator M.G. Lord. Turn in and listen. My guest tonight is Jorgis entrepreneur, Dennywood activist, Manuel Ramirez. Manny is the owner and operator of Dictus Pharmacy, an icon of Inwood. For the benefit of listeners not familiar with the term Inwood, it is the northernmost neighborhood on Manhattan Island, with the Harlem River marking its eastern and northern boundaries, and the Hudson River on the west. Generally, the 187th Street is considered the southern boundary, and the highest numbered street in Inwood is 225th Street. When I grew up in Inwood, there were three drugstores that my family and I frequented. The Indian Road Pharmacy, I referred to as Doc's, on the corner of Indian Road and 218th Street. Doc's, in addition to being a standard pharmacy, had a soda fountain that served sandwich, soda, ice cream, and malted. It also sold newspapers, magazines, and comics. It was one of my favorite places. Then there was the Isham Park Pharmacy, which he called the Perk, which is located on the corner of Isham Street and Broadway. It had, in addition to the pharmacy, a full lunch counter, from which one of the cooks ran the numbers racket. People stopped for coffee and an English in the morning before going into the 8th Avenue station to take the A train downtown to jobs. And then there was Dictors, located in the block between Ison Street and 27th Street, close to 27th Street. To me growing up, Dictors was a boring drugstore. It didn't have a soda fountain or sell comics or magazines, but it was where my parents filled their prescriptions. As I got older, my friend Paul Bishop worked there as the clerk and delivery boy. Another incident that involved Dictors before Johnny was born, the night was that the Baltimore Colts and Johnny Unitas won the NFL championship by beating the Giants in overtime. We may get into that later. Years after Paul worked there, Manny had the same type of job as the Dictors. And then years later, after a successful career of the druggist and manager with large drug chains, came back to Dictors as the owner. And after the major fire, expanded it to include the coffee and ice cream bar. We'll explore Manny's journey in depth tonight on the John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Manny, and welcome to the show.
Good evening, John. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and then go to early school?
Well, in the beginning, I went to Good Shepherd. My family resided on Academy Street between Sherman and Vermilia in Inwood. And on my 10th birthday that summer, we moved to Park Terrace East. So I spent the summers of the late 70s in Park Terrace East, Inwood Hill Park, Isham Park, growing up there.
What led you to go to work at a relatively young age at Dichter's, and did you want to be the druggist at the beginning, or did the Dichter's experience move you toward that career?
It's pretty interesting. I started there in my freshman year of high school. A friend of ours, the gang that we had, the group of guys, moved to Los Angeles. And upon finding out that he was moving, I asked him if he would introduce me to his boss and get me a job. He told me to wear my my gym shirt, which was a Bronx High School of Science gym shirt, and when I go see the boss, I wanted to make a good impression. I wore the T-shirt. The boss saw it. He said, "Oh, you must be a pretty bright guy." And I said, "Well, I think so." And we started working. I started cleaning shelves at the ripe old age of about 13 and a half for 25 cents an hour.
See, it's funny you mentioned Bronx High School of Science. When I went to Good Shepherd, they told us nothing about public schools. And in fact, the joke was, the principal, he would say, if you don't pick up your marks, you'll wind up in Mount St. George, which was his name for George Washington. But we were never told about Stuyvesant or Bronx High School of Science. In your time in Good Shepherd, were you encouraged to apply to those schools?
Well, it was similar to what you're referring to. We had a my brother went to Regis, and I have a twin sister, and she went to Mount St. Ursula, and we were encouraged to go to all the schools or open houses. But the nuns and the brothers said, "Well, there's the Bronx Science test that you would sit for," and there were probably about 20 of us who sat for the test that year. We all met together. We decided to go to meet at G's. Then we got on the bus. We went and took the test all together that year.
Tell us about your experience at Bronx Science. Was it as intensive as many people say? Did they lose students? How was it when you went there?
My freshman year when I got there, it was intimidating but very it was one of those aha moments. I got there and I saw how large the school was and how diverse the school was. I started in 1982 at Bronx Science, and it was quite diverse, much more diverse than it is now. And just seeing that type of diversity I embraced it. I thought it was wonderful. I was like, wow, I really arrived. This was a great choice, because my other choice was either to go to Cardinal Spellman or to Regis. And I said, well, let me try Bronx Science. And I had to make an agreement with my mother that I would sing in the Good Shepherd Choir on Sundays so that I would keep going to Mass. She was very adamant about that. That was the only way I could go to a public high school. Being there, it was wonderful. The different types, even in freshman year, I remember my freshman English teacher, Ms. Simmons, and just the ways that she would talk about the different books and how into her work she was. I really loved that.
You mentioned diversity, and the neighborhood, the neighborhood that I grew up in was an Irish Catholic Jewish neighborhood. The Irish Catholic lads played sports and drank beer, while the Jewish lads studied and played sports. After I left Inwood, the neighborhood was changing with an influx of Dominican Americans and yuppies up in the area that you lived on Park Terrace. I'm told the Paulists have a lot to do with the smoothing over of the mixing. I remember when Jim Casey and I carried the flags in the post 9/11 candlelight vigil. When we ended in the packed Good Shepherd Church, Father Marcus Zamora, the pastor, spoke in Spanish, and Father Kevin Devine, an old friend of mine, spoke in English, and there seemed to be a real community there, even though that many of the people spoke different languages from the other. Was it smooth when you were growing up, or was there tension between the groups?
Well, it was. I had to find my way. My parents are Puerto Rican. I'm New Yorican. We're not the majority of nationality in Good Shepherd. We were still mainly Irish. There were fewer Jewish people in the neighborhood at the time. The neighborhood was turning more Dominican. There were some Mexicans and Central Americans coming in. And you just have to, I guess like in many neighborhoods, you just have to find your clique. There was another Spanish guy and in my group, and the rest of the guys were Irish, and we were really sort of we weren't the cool crowd, the park crowd, or the guys who would go to the circle and do whatever they do in the park there. We played a lot of stickball, a lot of sports in the street, and we hung tight together. The biggest problem I had was seeing who I was, you know, because being, it was, growing up, the hard part was I was a little too Caucasian for the Spanish group and a little too Latin for the Caucasian group. So going to Bronx Science actually smoothed all that over, gave me my identity. I think a lot of young people go through that, but that's, being in this neighborhood, it sort of brought it to the surface a lot. Who am I? Where am I going? What am I doing? And when I look back at my childhood, I had a great one. Many people, I'm sure yourself included, when they look back at their childhood and inward, would put it up against anybody's childhood anywhere because of the parks and the movie theaters and all the different things that were available. So, like I said, it was a rite of passage like most kids.
Yeah, the park gave us some freedom. It was where we first smoked and drank anyhow, where there was the only area that there wouldn't be some adult that would see us, and by the time that we got home, the word would be home. So it was there was some freedom, but there was also not the concern that there is now with children drinking in the suburbs, where they get into cars to go someplace. So we tend to stay in the neighborhood, you know, the neighborhood.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was interesting. It was funny, a friend of mine who I went through grammar school, high school, and college with, John Davis, became a Dominican priest. And about 5 or 6 years ago, a fellow from the neighborhood died, Neil Lyons, and I called John, who was at that time down on around NYU, and I mentioned that this fellow had passed away. So he said, I'm going to call the pastor of Good Shepherd and see if I can say a mass in memory of him, and then I'll go to the wake. So he called the pastor, and the pastor said, sure, come on up. So when I ran into the wake, he said that when he went down into the sacristy, he was wearing the black jacket. And there was no one there but someone who must have been the caretaker. And then a fellow said very aggressively, who are you? And he said, I'm a Dominican. You don't look Dominican.
Yeah, there was that confusion.
Two different words.
Yeah, definitely, Dominican. And even with one of the girls graduating from Shepherd, later on went to Dominican College. And
okay.
She was Irish. And
okay.
Someone had made a comment about that. Oh, this is gonna, and I said, I think you guys need to look that up. You might be a little mistaken. It's very funny.
And then after science, what led you to decide to be a druggist? Was it your inward, your addictive background, or was there anything else there?
Absolutely. There was working in Victor. It was also a great. It was a great experience as a kid working there. You get to talk to people, which is I love doing that, and I learned a lot from my old boss. He was a very strict guy, and just the way that he came across, he said to me, "If you can work for me, you can work for anybody." And one thing in particular, I have an older brother. He's about 5 years older than I am, and he went to Cornell University after going to Regis. And he graduated Cornell in 1985. And those times were similar to times now. A lot of people coming out of college weren't getting jobs in their field. And I see him, and he comes out. And when he came back, I was very proud of him. I was like, wow, it's my brother. He went to an Ivy League school. And he looked around, and at first he had to get a job in Pathmark down in the neighborhood. And I saw that, and I was a little disheartened. I said, "Wow, you know, and times are tough, and you gotta get what you get." Soon after that, he did well and progressed in his career, and he's doing fine now. But that made an impact on me. And I talked to my boss about that, and I said, "You know, I want to, you know, I don't want to have to do that. Can I become a pharmacist? You think? Do you think that would work out for me?" And he said something that stayed in my mind. And it rings true about pharmacy. He says, you'll never be super rich, but you'll always have a job. And that kind of answered the question for me. I was like, wow, that's great. I'll always have a job. That's exactly what I want, and it's in a field that I like, so let's have at it.
Part of the pharmacist may have changed from when I was young. I remember before you were born, the New York Football Giants and the Baltimore Colts played in what was considered called the greatest game ever played, because it really brought the National Football League to the attention of everyone. It was an overtime game for the NFL championship. And I was at the game. And the Giants lost, but I came home with part of the goalpost that they're wooden at that time, and I still have it in my bedroom. But when I came off the subway, and this is a Sunday afternoon, a friend of mine wanted to cut a piece off, and he took his knife out, and he cut a piece off for himself, and in doing that, he badly slashed his finger. He still has a scar. And he went around the corner. Dixon's was open, and the pharmacist performed first aid. The pharmacist disinfected the wound and bandage it for him, and other things. Now, it's my understanding that pharmacists would be reluctant to do that now, to consider it of the purview of the doctor, and they'd be afraid of getting sued. Is that true?
Well, it depends upon the situation. If someone walks in with a serious wound that needs stitching or that kind of aid, then I would either call 911 for the person, or I would definitely look at it and see what's going on. But I have on many, many occasions, especially for people I know, or if a parent to bring their child in, fixed a couple scrapes, bruises, give people a butterfly stitch. Yeah, I use, and it's always no charge. You do that pro bono. That's something that was taught to me. I had some similar situations like your friend did, watching my old boss take care of people. But also in pharmacy school, I went to the Albany College of Pharmacy, and in the time that I went there, it was really all about being the profession of pharmacy, and the pride in that, and what it takes, and the history. So all of that, where the pharmacist is like a little hub for the community, all of that was instilled in me from early on. So to answer your question, absolutely. It depends on the situation. But if, Don, if you came in and you needed a stitch, I would definitely stitch you up and do everything I possibly can to get you back on your feet.
You mentioned the Albany College of Pharmacy. We'll go into that in a moment. But a close friend of mine went to the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy.
Oh, yeah.
But he used that as a jumping off point, because they had scholarships to Jefferson School of Medicine. He's been a doctor for 50 years now. Did you ever consider becoming a physician or not?
That question is asked to me all the time. And the answer, I never thought about being a physician. And I don't think it was because I thought I couldn't. It was just never brought up. When the time came, I kind of set myself on being a pharmacist, and that was good enough for me. I quickly did the math, and I just said 5 years. Back then it was 5 years. Come out with a degree, start working. That's fine with me.
You mentioned earlier that you'll never be rich, but you'll always have a job. His two of his children are pharmacists, and when they graduated, they were both hired by CVS. And they went in at the salary that was a good deal higher than other college graduates, and he said that the chains at that time were expanding so rapidly they were just buying the degrees to have registered pharmacists, and that was why they started to something like 65,000 when the average college graduate was lucky to get 40. Have the salary changed since your boss told you that you'll never get rich as a pharmacist?
Well, salaries have consistently gone up. The when I got out, there were lots of incentives to go here or go there. They pay for moving. They give you a signing bonus. All sorts of stuff like that was negotiated. When I became a multi-store supervisor for Rite Aid, my first challenge was we had to open 30 stores in the Bronx in about 6 to 9 months. So I wouldn't say we were buying licenses, but if you had a license, you had a tremendous opportunity. Salaries haven't gone down lately, but there was always that saying out there, oh, you're going to soon there'll be too many pharmacists, and this time will dry up. And nobody ever believed it, but it seems to be happening now. There are a lot more schools of pharmacy in the Northeast, and the signing bonuses are gone. Some of the pharmacists that I know are working without benefits. They're not given benefits anymore in the smaller independents. And the times have changed. The salary, the dollar salary, hasn't gone down, but some of the perks have.
Tell us about college. Was it difficult? You came from challenging high schools, certainly. Was college as challenging for you?
Academically, not at all. They were great there. They gave when you go to the Albany College of Pharmacy in the 80s, it was about pharmacy life, and everything was, and they would support you, and everything was about school. It was part of Union University in Schenectady. So the life was, it was a small school. There were about only about 600 or 700 people in a 5-year program. So you would do all your studying together. You would socialize with the same group of people. So everybody would, it was a pharmacy life. The harder part for me was socially, coming from New York City to Albany, New York in the 80s. It was very non-urban. It was a city, but it just was not the same. And I had some adjusting issues to do there. It was there weren't that many. The diversity wasn't there. It was very Caucasian, WASPy group of people. And one woman even said I was the first Puerto Rican that she ever met. So that was. That was a little more difficult for me than the academics. The academics were pretty straightforward.
If you weren't in the state government, it was fairly boring. Albany as a town. I know that a friend of mine went to Union College, and I mentioned to him after you told me that Albany was part of Union University that I hadn't realized that. There was this umbrella. So he said that they made a big deal when he went to Union College that the university was modeled on the English and the European universities, where we know about Oxford, but if people went to Oxford, they always said they went to this college that was part of Oxford. They never said just that they went to Oxford. And the union said they were like that, that they were the over umbrella, but each of the colleges was independent in its own right.
Exactly. That's exactly how it was in the 80s. We had Albany Law, Albany Med, and Albany Pharmacy. Each gave out their own diplomas, but under the auspices of Union University in Schenectady. One guy played football for them, but that seemed too challenging with the pharmacy schedule. So after about 2 years, he couldn't do it anymore.
Okay. After graduation, you came back to Dictus for a while, didn't you?
Yes, after graduation, I came down, lived with Mom for about 6 months. That didn't last too long. And got my first bachelor pad on Isham Street and worked for Dictor for about two and a half years as a pharmacist.
And then you went on to chains, and you also had some corporate experience. You just mentioned managing groups of stores. Tell us about that.
It started in Dictor. I just wanted more. I was working for a gentleman who owned a few stores, and I was young, and I wanted more. I wanted more responsibility. And he was running the store, and he said, "Well, you know, you're either going to have to be patient or maybe look for something else." And I said, "Well, I think I'm going to look for someone else." And at the same time, I met a young woman in New Jersey, and as many stories go, I just went to New Jersey and started working for Rite Aid, for one of the chains. And I started in Passaic, New Jersey, as a pharmacist. And then when this chain did a large expansion in Manhattan, knowing that I was from the area, they brought me back. And I started at this one location in Manhattan and quickly got promoted to area pharmacy supervisor. And being 24 years old, I was given a laptop, a cell phone. It was wonderful. I was like, wow, this was a great choice. This is something wonderful that I did. I'm really going to be so impactful, you know, change the world, the pharmacy. But it was very difficult. Like I said, we had to hire a lot of pharmacists and scheduling. It was very difficult. I thought I would make every pharmacy a man's pharmacy. But that didn't come to pass. I just wasn't able to do that. I moved over to another chain. They had scouted me out and made me an offer. And working for them was very good in the sense that they sold a lot of front-end merchandise. So we were moving a lot of merchandise, which I had less experience in. I was basically a back-end guy. And now I'm learning the front-end, and that was really good. I trained in Manhattan as an area supervisor there, and they shipped me out to Brooklyn and Queens for their expansion. And that was very exciting. Unfortunately, corporate life is not for me. The situation that broke the camel's back was I had to fire a manager. He was doing something he shouldn't have been doing. And the way that the corporation went about it, I thought that maybe there would be another way, an easier, softer way to handle this. But there wasn't. And that was it. I was done. I realized that I'm really a corner druggist. I'm not a corporate guy. And I went back to independent pharmacy after a run of about 7 or 8 years with the chains.
And then finally back to Dictus again. Tell us about that. How'd you get back?
I had worked 7 years in this one store in Teaneck, New Jersey. And the pharmacy world is small. The owner of the pharmacy had a connection to the owner of Dictus Pharmacy. And I had always spoken of my old boss and how much he trained me, and he called me, my current boss at the time called me and said that he heard that my first boss at Dictor had passed. So I called Dictor Pharmacy to give my condolences, and the daughter-in-law of the owner picks up the phone. She remembered who I was and asked me if I wanted to purchase the store. And I did what any good Catholic boy would do. I called my mom up and asked her what she thought. She gave me some good words of advice, and I went in 2007. I purchased Dick the Pharmacy.
And you're back in the neighborhood, and you're building the pharmacy, and you know from and you're known for your good service. I've had friends that even before I knew you, like Roberta McHale, who spoke so well of your service. And then you find out that the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of New York, which had been helping support the grammar school, which you and I and so many others attended, was closing the school. I know that you in some way hooked up with two fellows from my generation, Richie Scalata and John Brennan, to try to come up with a plan to not only prevent the closing, but to revitalize the school. How did that come about?
Like you said, there was foreshadowing that the Archdiocese had problems with the Shepherd in many schools, and I was always concerned about that. I loved Good Shepherd, and I thought the nuns really gave me a good upbringing. And when I heard that they were in trouble, I was concerned. And it was quite odd. We just received a phone call out of the blue on my cell phone, and it was from the Archdiocese. And they had requested if I wanted to meet the superintendent. And I really didn't know much about education at that time, so I really didn't know what that meant. But I'm always a yes guy, and I said, yeah, sure, I'll meet him. What do I got to do? And so I met him at Good Shepherd. And he started talking to me. And when we started, Dr. Tim McNiff, and when we started talking, he said, what do I think could be done? And I was very positive because I really thought that the love for the Good Shepherd would shine through and we'd be able to keep it open. They subsequently put up an article in the paper saying that they were going to close Good Shepherd without any discussion. So I called again. And they asked me to come down to the downtown office, and there is where I met John and Rich. And the three of us got together, and the three of us wanted to keep the school open, John being the main benefactor. And together with the pastor, we were able, thank God, to save the school, and it's doing very well.
I know that they had to do something because when the Franciscans came in to replace the Paulists, part of the deal was that they were not responsible for the school, and the Archdiocese was. Now, understand that the pastor that you were dealing with, he wanted to take the school back anyhow. Is that true?
We were given the opportunity to make Good Shepherd a parish school again, as opposed to a archdiocesan school under the auspices of the management of the Archdiocese. And we were given certain hurdles to overcome and had to create a plan. And with the principal, the pastor, Rich, John, and myself, we formulated this plan. And the pastor is an educator, Father Robert. He's an educator. I would assume a lot of them, when they go to seminary school, they come out as teachers. And he was very passionate about the teaching and keeping the school open. So together, we all formed this plan on how we're going to do things and reach out and increase enrollment. And we were allowed to stay open and become a parish school.
In speaking to my ex-pastor here, he said that any parish that has a school is in financial trouble, and I don't know how it was when you went there, but when I was there, we didn't pay any tuition. It all came out of the collection plate, but the brothers and the nuns were paid off in the dark because the money went into the order, and the order gave them what they felt was needed at the time. They fed them, they clothed them, and if they needed something for something, they got the money, but obviously it was not a whole lot. Now, then when the orders dwindled, the lay people, very often with a family, they wanted to number one, have benefits, and number two, to have a reasonable wage comparable to the public schools. And it was a whole new ball game. And then you got a whole bunch of new people in Good Shepherd who very often didn't have the money for a $4,000 your intuition. How did you overcome all these things?
Well, Good Shepherd, just to take a step back, Good Shepherd, when I was in Good Shepherd in the late 70s, early 80s, there was a tuition. And
okay.
So they had started that quite a while ago. The funding of a lot of the schools, you're correct, they are underwater. They don't make enough. They weren't making enough money to cover their expenses, and the archdiocese would then cover their expenses. The first thing that had to be done, and this was Rich's expertise was in financing, was to find out what's going on. As in any organization, when there's expenses and revenue, things have to be put in order. And quickly, Rich got on that, put everything in order. And when we saw the order, we were amazed. And we, John, with former CEO of a large company, took the helm, and Father Robert executed many of the ideas, and we all got pitching together, thinking what we could do. At the time, Good Shepherd didn't have a full 8 grades. There was I believe it was the 5th and the 6th grade were combined. And to be competitive in the New York education market, things had to be changed immediately. And I think that was one of the great things that our team was able to do, was identify the problems, formulate great ideas, and execute them.
So I know that the school was hurt. When I was young, there was another church. It was called the Chapel, which was the original Good Shepherd Church. When they put up the present church, they moved this older church up next to the school. And then after I graduated, they expanded the school. They took down the chapel, and they expanded the auditorium and the gym and everything. And but they had that rented out for a while, first to Mercy College, and then Mercy closed that, and then to the borough, the Manhattan Community College. And they had to get out because it wasn't disabled. There wasn't access for disabled. So in some way, you guys were able to entice this charter school in there. So that must be a help in the revenue.
Yeah, yes. The Archdiocese has a team for everything, and they have a team that looks to get tenants. As we've seen lately, Mother Cabrini is closing, and they're getting a success academy. There are people down there that do that full time, look for tenants, and we were given the opportunity to team with Inwood Academy, and typical deal. You work out a lease, you work out all sorts of where they can go, where we go, and it's been working nice. I think it's been about three years now that they've been here. They have been in existence in Inwood for quite some time, and they're expanding, and we needed a tenant, so it was a win-win for both of us.
I know that the three of you, you and Richie and John, have been honored at festivities at the school, and Bishop Jerry Walsh, who's a Good Shepherd graduate, who coincidentally he was taught by my late brother that I own, that he was active with you, and he was part of the group honoring you. How did that feel after graduating from the grammar school years before to be the subject of of being honored there?
It was wonderful. It was this past year. I have the award in my home, prominently displayed, and actually my first award of that nature, and it was great. It's standing in the auditorium that we square danced in, and having my peers say that, I did a pretty cool thing, it was great. Definitely one of those aha moments. Just fuels the fire to continue to, like I said in my speech, to serve and to love.
That's terrific. And then with the school on the road to recovery and business doing nicely, came the fire that not only wiped out your store, but the entire northwest corner of 7th Street and Broadway. Tell us about that and your initial reaction. How did it start, anyhow?
It started in a an adjacent restaurant that was under construction at around 11 o'clock, January 3rd, 2011, I think it was.
That night at 11 o'clock? Or in the day?
Yeah, 11 o'clock at night, unfortunately. Yeah, I received a phone call from a fellow Good Shepherd alum who was dining in the Garden Cafe a few doors down, that the stores were on fire. And I did something that I probably wouldn't do if, God forbid, it ever happens, and I tell all the viewers not to do this. I got in my car and I went to go to the store. And it was probably one of the lowest points of my life here. I'm standing there helpless, watching my life savings, my life's work go literally up in flames. It was a very cold night, and the water was freezing, and I would see firemen falling and slipping around and just watching the whole place burn down. And there were blasts, and all of Broadway was full of black smoke. And so I think I would probably not do that again. I would probably stay home. Hopefully I never have to do that again, but that was terrible. Right after the fire, though, was probably one of the brightest parts of my life. The neighborhood really rallied around, my high school friends formed a web page. The neighborhood formed a Facebook page where people would be able to contribute to all the stores financially and through service. And there were about 7 or 8 people who came down every day and helped me rebuild. I quickly got a location about a block north. I knew the landlord. It was actually the landlord of the building when I first came back from college who gave me an apartment, my first bachelor pad. He knew me, and he gave me a very nice little spot at a very nice rent. And people came, and they had literally built my store with me. The neighborhood donated enough money so I can buy my sign out front. The labor, free labor from all the in Williams, put up the whole store, placed the merchandise out, priced the merchandise.
Now, had your inventory been insured? I mean, how did you build a new inventory of
We had insurance. Everything was totaled and lost. The Board of Pharmacy deemed it unusable. And the insurance money was very slow. As most people probably know, it's very slow in coming. And in the pharmacy business, if you're out of business even one day, someone's going to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
So I knew that time was of the essence. So the fire was January 3rd. On January 14th, Martin Luther King Day, we opened up our new location, up and running full blast. Through the efforts of my workers who stayed with me, myself, tireless hours, and the community, we in about, what is that, about 11 days, we reopened.
I know that that you didn't lose your customers. I know that Roberta Michaela, who I mentioned earlier, said to me that your customers had to be loyal because you've been providing such great service before that. Did you hold all your customers?
We didn't hold all of our customers. And I just want to say as a side note, Roberta, I was delivering to Roberta back when I was like 13 years old. She's just a handful of people who have stayed with Dictor for decades. And I was just thinking when you mentioned her name, how long I've known her as a child and now as a grown man, and that's a great feeling. But most of my customers stayed. I would say about 80% stayed, 20% did not. In New York, you move a block away and you're almost in a whole other demographic, and it's sort of that, you probably know the expression, it's the other way. Do you go to this X, Y, or Z place? No, because it's the other way. So if you're on your way and something's on the other side, you just don't frequent it. So that happened, about 20% of my customers I lost about.
Now, when you were able to move back into your original location, the new store was bigger with the aforementioned coffee bar and the ice cream bar. How did that happen? How did you get more space?
Well, I knew that this space was temporary. I couldn't stay there in the long run with the way pharmacy is going, that the space was just too small. I needed to expand. So I was always on the lookout. And the part of the store, of the building that I'm in now, was a Citibank. And their plans always were to move to the other side of the building. And when the landlord put up the rent sign, the neighborhood always knew how I felt. Someone came running in, "Manny, there's a Citibank is for rent. You gotta go. You gotta call the number." And I called the number, and I've known the landlord since I was a kid. And he said to me, "The place is too big." I said, No. I said, "If you want to get rid of Citibank, I'll take the whole thing." But because I had an idea, a vision of what I wanted to do, and we worked out a nice agreement, and I took possession of the store in January of 2013.
In addition to the coffee bar and ice cream that I mentioned before, you've turned the expanded store into the mini community center. Tell us about the other many Dicta-related activities that are in progress and going.
That was the vision that I had. That's why I if Citibank ever leaves, I'm definitely taking the rest of the space. The idea how the community came to my aid and just rang in my heart, and I was just like, well, I have to give back. And you know, in a Catholic, that's what we do. We might not have much, but we share what we have. At least that's what the nun taught me. And we ended up taking possession, and it took about 5 months to build it out, 4 or 5 months to build it out. And a friend of mine from high school said to me that you need to make some poetry readings and art displays. And I really wasn't into it at the time. This was a few years ago. And it just came and hit me again and said, well, you know what, now we can do this here. And Inwood, as you had mentioned earlier, is changing. And now there's a tremendous amount of artists and musicians and performers, and I hadn't gotten to know them in these past couple of years. And I said, well, let me see if I can give some space. And right after that, someone said, why don't you have a person play the violin here on a Sunday? Wouldn't that be nice to listen to? When I posted a picture of this violin player, a friend of mine from high school said, why aren't you doing poetry? And I said, well, I'm not a poet. He goes, well, I'll come and I'll do the poetry. I was like, great, come on down. And that's how the poetry got started. And someone said, why don't you put, in Inwood and in Washington Heights, there's the North Manhattan Art Stroll, NOMA. Someone said, why don't you get into NOMA and have a couple artists exhibit in your store? And I was like, sure, let's do that too. So then someone said, why don't you have this free preschool meets in the park, but it's wintertime, so they need an indoor place. Why don't you give them space? I said, sure, tell them to come, and they came, and we had a little preschool on the planet for the winter months. So it was basically just saying yes. The ideas and people came to me, and I just said yes,
poetry,
let's do it.
The poetry I read at one of the poetry sessions, one of your early ones. And it's interesting, that stroll, I was contacted a year and a half ago for the one they had, and I was asked to post poetry and to come into a place that didn't exist when I lived in the neighborhood. There's a very active Mormon church down on Riverside Drive.
Yes.
And that's only been there a couple of years. Now, speaking of churches and everything, you also provide space to a Jewish group, and I understand that there are no longer any synagogues, which surprises me. Tell us about that.
Yes, yeah. As I had mentioned, when I was growing up in Inwood, the Jewish population was dwindling down. I do remember the synagogues. My first employer at Dicta was Jewish, and subsequent to that, they all closed. In Washington Heights, conversely, there's a very strong Jewish community, and they have a few, maybe several synagogues, but in Inwood there weren't any. And I was approached by a gentleman who I had seen in the neighborhood who was doing events for Jewish holidays in the park. And I met him one day, and we talked, and I don't know if he said to me or I said to him, but I said, why don't you have your services and in the pharmacy, and if anything, you can have that the Shabbat dinner. And he thought it over. He agreed, and that sort of made a big spark subsequent to the group is called Inwood Jews. Subsequent to the Inwood Jews meeting in Dicta Pharmacy on Thursdays for their Talmud discussion, they would meet the last Friday of every month for their Shabbat dinner. That the local papers, the New York Times and subsequently the Wall Street Journal, New York Magazine, all heard about this, and they wrote articles about us.
And the New York Magazine had, I knew that Jim Dwyer of the Times, who's been a good friend to Inwood, and
yes.
Who lives in Washington Heights, he had interviewed you, hadn't he?
Yes, and there was an interview in the Wall Street Journal, and the first interview was in New York Magazine, and it was actually about gentrification in Inwood. And the author came to me, and we spoke for about an hour, and the gist of what I was telling him was that it's on the business owners to adapt to the neighborhood. As a pharmacist, I take an oath to serve my community. It doesn't say serve the old community or the new community or both. It says to serve. So we were talking about that and how I have to, I have to be current. If the new community takes these kind of health ingredients, I need to keep that in. And that idea of inclusion and keeping everything smooth and non-polarized caught the attention of Jim Dwyer, who came to me and asked me about the things that I was doing. And we talked about all the different events we have and how being a central part of the community is part of my mission statement, my business plan to make Dicta Pharmacy a central hub for the Inwood and adjoining communities.
Yeah, I found your view of Dicta's, as you described it to me in a note, to be very eloquent, and I'm going to quote it. Dicta Pharmacy is an inclusive site for all who seek positive energy, healing, a sense of community, and a hub for souls looking to connect. We are not just a pharmacy, we are much more. Our brand of pharmacy is for all social, economic, and spiritual groups. Healing is about the mind, body, and spirit. We have the soda shop to facilitate this goal. Most beings need space and some sort of nourishment. When provided these, they will frequent more often, giving me a better opportunity to connect and to heal them to different levels. I spend much of my time getting to know people. This is the real gift of being a pharmacist, walking with people in their life's journey. Are you sure you weren't an English major?
Sometimes the spirit moves me.
that was extremely eloquent. And would you consider that to be almost your business plan?
100%. Exactly. Spot on. That's what the pharmacy is about, day in and day out.
Okay. Now, do you see the neighborhood? We've already gone from Jewish and Irish Catholic to Dominican and up around Park Terrace and Guppies. I mean, I knew a doctor who bought one of the penthouses in Isham Gardens, in Park Terrace Gardens, where the friends of mine had lived. And he didn't get in when they first went co-op. He got in for $7,500, and he was at Jacoby and other places doing his internship. And he sold 7 years later for $87,000, and he moved up, and he's been my doctor for for 35 years, but I understand now that those same apartments that they're going for $750,000, $800,000, and the house, the block that I grew up on, between 218th Street and 215th Street on Seaman Avenue, all of those houses look better now than they did the 55 years ago. They've done marvelous jobs in steam cleaning and everything, and they're getting what in our day would be considered outrageous money for it. But it's a wonderful place to live. It's the last stop on the A train. It's got that wonderful park. There was a book written about it by Mary Elizabeth Williams, who writes for Salon, called Give Me Shelter, about her looking for a place to live and buying into a house that coincidentally is the house that Richie Scotto grew up in. And she had her book signing at the Indian Road Cafe. So what do you see for the neighborhood with the diversity now, which is different than the diversity when you grew up?
It's definitely changing. And I just want to bring one thing to light. I'm sitting here in front of the peninsula or island, whatever time you grew up in Inwood, you call it, the 218th Street and Indian Road. And I see the same thing that I've always seen. I see families. I see families that are, they're different types of families, and I see groups of people who are enjoying the space. And like I mentioned before, growing up in Inwood was wonderful. We enjoyed Inwood. We enjoyed the space. And the people today are doing the same as the people 50 years ago, 20 years ago. They enjoy the space. The demographics has changed. As you mentioned, the price of an apartment or a co-op has skyrocketed. So certain demographics are priced out of Inwood. But there are still rent control, rent stabilized apartments. Many people are still here. And you see another group of people whose parents were tenants, and they still live with their parents. So the end effect is that there's a tremendous diversity, older, young, you're what would have been said the old nuclear family. There are new types of nuclear families here. There's a lot of there are different religious groups that are here that do many events, and the idea of living in Inwood is the same as it was before. It's a great place with many resources. The one difference that I do see, one marked difference, is that there was a lot more cooking done in the apartments back in when I was growing up. Now there's a lot of takeout and there's a lot of restaurants. So I would say that's different. Maybe that's a trend in society. But other than that, it's about using the resources, people enjoying themselves. Inwood Little League is still around. So that's where you see a nice mix of different cultures. In the Little League, you see the Latino children with the non-Latino children playing for Dick the Pharmacy. We've had a team for quite a while. And for the different teams, I don't like to chime in on how different the things are now. I believe in being positive about things. I see that I look for the similarities. It's about families enjoying the park and enjoying the religious services, enjoying the civic services. You see the people are still marching for the Memorial Day parade. People are still getting together for the 9/11 ceremonies. I can't talk enough about how great I think Inwood is.
Yeah, it's interesting. But we have a caller on the line. Let me see who the caller is. A caller from 914. Who are you?
Dan Sheehan.
What?
Dan Sheehan. Hello, John.
Hello, Dan. Dan is the person, Manny, that cut his finger and was sewn up by your boss, I guess.
How you doing, Dan? Yeah,
very good, Manny. How are you?
I'm good. I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What was the name of the pharmacist or who took care of you? Do you remember?
Oh, I don't know, but I guess it was Dicker's Drugstore, but I don't remember the pharmacist's name at all. John would probably remember. He was there.
So, but I didn't know the pharmacist. I just knew that they were older people who took care of us, and that Paul Bishop had worked there.
Yes.
Yeah, I had cut my finger there. John had a hunk of the goalpost from the giant Baltimore Colts 1958 overtime game, and I had a small pocket knife that was very sharp, and I was cutting the goalpost so I could get a piece of it. The knife slipped, went right across my thumb, and cut the side of my finger right across the whole fingernail.
Wow!
It was bleeding like mad, obviously. So the drugstore was right there. In those days, you went to the drugstore. So we went in, and I remember it was the first time I ever heard of it, and I still remember that he used mercuric oxide powder to stop the bleeding.
Oh, yeah.
And then he put a bandage on it, and that was the end of it. I still have the scar.
Do you still have the piece of wood, though?
Probably not.
I do.
Yeah, I know you would. Now, I've moved too many times over the years.
Manny was just talking about the neighborhood and how that he tries to dwell on the similarities. One of the most eloquent things I heard about that, my wife Barbara used to be on the board of Mount St. Michael's High School, and I was at a dinner that was with their high rollers and the people that are on the board and everything. The president of the board of trustees, fellow Vince Permuto, who had been an all-pro tackle for the Washington Redskins, and he was a lawyer, and he stood up and he was talking, and he said that when we went to the school, it was the school for first and second generation children, mainly Italians. He said, it's the same school now. He said, the color of the skin may be different for many, and the language they come in with may be different, but it's the same school, it's the same children of hardworking parents who want their children to have an education and to do well. And I'm sure that in your work at Good Shepherd that you found the same thing, Manny.
Absolutely. I had, when I first bought Dictor, one of the first re-exposures to Good Shepherd, one of the teachers came in and she had purchased a pencil sharpener, and there was a problem with it. And I just asked, I said, are you a teacher? And she said, yes. And I said, what school? She said, Good Shepherd. I said, okay, well, come back tomorrow and I'll give you a new stapler, and I'll give you a few. So what I ended up doing was I ended up buying about 5 electric staplers, and I gave them to her, and I said, listen, I'm a Good Shepherd graduate. Take these staplers, give them out, sharpeners, give them out to your other teachers, and if there's anything I can help you with, let me know. The day later, she came back with a big paper. She was a third grade teacher, and the kids had all signed their name and made little drawings, and they made a drawing of a pharmacist, and it just melted me. I said, "Oh my God! You know, these are kids who need help, and just like I was a kid who needed help, and I was compelled. I was just compelled. I said, it's the same. These are kids who want to learn." Who are learning about, you know, the Catholic faith, and really nothing's changed. They have a teacher who uses pencils, and when the pencil sharpener breaks, they go get a new pencil sharpener. The same. It's how you look at it.
I never looked at it that way. That's excellent, really. You know?
To keep this generation together, the cross generation, the assistant principal to Good Shepherd is the widow of an old friend and a classmate of Dan's from Good Shepherd, Jack Walsh. So it all kind of hangs together, Ronnie Woisen and Walsh. So.
She started off at the board, and then we needed more office resources. There was a lot to be done, and Ronnie stepped up, and She's been the assistant principal, I believe, for 2, maybe going on 3 years. And it's just part of the growth that we have. We identify situations and we address them.
Now, when you and Richie and John got involved, and by the way, both of them are Manhattan Prep graduates, where Dan was a graduate of. Richie stayed with Manhattan College, and John went off to Fort Schuyler. What was the enrollment then, and then what is it now?
Back then, there was about, the actual number escapes me, but it was about 100 and change. It was a very low number. And we had set goals and of what we wanted to reach. And with the closing of St. Jude, we reached the goal actually a year and a half, 2 years before our plan. So that was actually beneficial for Good Shepherd, as most people thought it would be. Right now, we're hovering somewhere around 300 and change, which is a lot less than when you guys and I went to school.
Now, that 110, our graduating class, if you took the boys and the girls together, one class would have been a good deal higher than that.
Sure. We had four classes of at least 30 when I graduated, so that's 120.
Yeah, Dan and I had 44, 45 in our classes, didn't we, Dan?
Oh, I remember looking at the blackboard because they'd have the attendance on the corner up there every morning, and we had, I don't know if it was the fifth or sixth grade or seventh grade, but I remember seeing 56 on the blackboard.
Wow.
You know what's interesting about that number? In those days, and in my days, Good Shepherd was the preferred school of Inwood. It was a very good school. Everybody wanted to go there. The education was top notch. And I had 30 students, you had 56. Nowadays, it's the opposite. If any school has that number of students, 56 would be, the union wouldn't allow anybody to have 56 students. But
and we didn't have any teacher's assistants either.
Oh, exactly. And they have formulas now. If you have this number of students, you got to have this number of aides. It's a quite a different world now. The better schools have 12 students in there. Of course, tuitions must be much higher, but I find it interesting. You guys have 56 children in the class. God bless those nuns, huh?
What's the story on the rumored combining of St. Jude's and Good Shepherd Parish? I understood that the principal was that the pastor wasn't happy with the proposed changing of the name of Good Shepherd. Do you know what's going on there?
To be honest, John, I don't know what's going on with that. I also had heard rumors and things were said, and I don't know anything concrete. I do know that the pastor there has been there for quite a long time, and if the orders are anything like a business, you know, he probably has seniority. You would think. I'm not sure how they operate there, but I don't have any concrete answers on that. I wish I did.
It's very different because Good Shepherd has Franciscans and St. Jude's has a diocesan priest. And so if the Franciscans, what I heard was that they were going to use St. Jude's only for Sunday masses, and there'd still obviously be Sunday masses in Good Shepherd, but it wouldn't be open really during the week, and the Good Shepherd would be the prime place. Go ahead.
Any of those situations, the scenarios, I'm sure could play out. We've seen in New York tons of schools and churches close. It's just when it comes to certain things, it's a numbers aspect. You know, who can pay the bills and that sort of situation. My takeaway from all of that is that it's a sad day when any Catholic institution closes their doors. It's a sign of the times, but it's still very sad for me.
Well, Dan and Enrique Scalata and John Brennan went to Manhattan Prep, which doesn't exist anymore, and Bishop Jerry Walsh went to Palm Memorial. And my brother had been the principal of that, and that doesn't exist anymore. There's an awful lot of high schools that were around when we were younger. There was Dubois and De La Salle, and as well as Manhattan Prep and Power, and Rice just closed. So there's a lot of Catholic schools that have fallen by the wayside.
Sure, and there's a lot of the churches, and there's a lot of sharing of resources in churches. While we were when we formed our group, we toured a few of the schools, and some of them didn't have churches with them. One school was sharing a church with another school that was a few blocks away, and they were saying how their pastor is some masses here, some masses in the other church. So maybe we need to do some recruiting for priests or something.
Dan, Newburgh's lost a bunch of Catholic schools, right? St. Patrick's.
Yeah, actually St. Patrick's, where I go to church, and we had a high school and a grammar school there. They closed many years ago. The high school actually closed in, I think it was 1968 or 69. And Jimmy Casey was a teacher there. He was one of the last four brothers there. There's a couple of guys that I know up here that graduated, I guess, in 1965. So this coming next year will be their 50th anniversary from St. Patrick's, and they're inviting Jimmy back. And because I know the guys and I know Jimmy, I've been invited to go to the 50th anniversary. So I definitely go to that.
He goes to many of the things. One of the people that Jim taught, Manny, is the author James Patterson, who was the
who was
the valedictorian then went on to Manhattan College.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, the ironical thing with Jimmy had asked the order, the De La Salle brother, to he and I think one or two of the other brothers, when they were told that the school was closing, they asked actually to see if they could set up a halfway house and deal with the drug addicts in the city of Newburgh. And the order said no, that wasn't their mission. So Jimmy actually took a leave of absence at that time. And then from what I remember, he never came back after the leave of absence. They lost a good man.
Yes.
Manny, you mentioned in your note to me that your children went to Good Shepherd. How old are they now? What are they doing?
No. I have a 17-year-old son and a 15-year-old son, and they live in New Jersey with their mother.
Okay.
And one goes to Paramus Catholic in Paramus, and the other one is going to be a senior in St. Peter's Prep in Jersey City.
Okay. Okay.
I just moved to Inwood in October of last year, so they're
okay.
Settled in New Jersey.
Okay, all right, and I thought that you had said that some of your children went there, but okay.
No. I have a daughter who's two. She's not old enough to enroll in Good Shepherd, but so I only have three children.
I'm sure they'll have room for her.
I'm sure they will.
We've covered a whole lot of bases. Is there anything else that you'd like the audience to know about Manny Ramirez?
Well, like you said, we've talked about a lot of things, and I thank you for saying that the words that I wrote were so eloquent, and they really ring true. And I just, part of the mission that I'm on, I believe, is to spread the message of, that we're here to, like they say at Mass, to love and serve. And I do that on a daily basis in my capacity. And I think that if people kept a conscious thought of that throughout the day, that a lot of things would really be better, because it's really just a simple act of how do we serve, how do we help. That's basically how all my conversations start. How can I help you? This is Manny. Good afternoon, Dick the Pharmacy. How can I help you? And I just, you know, that's part of what I think is most important of what I'm doing today, is spreading that word that, you know, we can help each other, and we really should help each other. Nobody is too high or too low that can't be helped.
The house that one of your main people behind this, DeSoto Fountain, Joe, lives in 583 West 15th Street, was the home of four of our closest friends growing up. It was they were all ensconced there. So and Jim Casey was one of them. Dan, do you have any questions for Manny before you go?
But the next, curious Manny, where is your shop located now? John said it's not where it used to be.
It's about 100 feet north. It's
so you're
49.
On the other side of 207th Street.
No, it's on the same side of 207th Street.
Across 207th.
Yes, we're in between 207th and Isham, 4953,
okay.
Right next to Citibank.
Oh, okay. All right.
Now,
down that way, I'll stop in.
I'll keep a light on.
When you come to the next luncheon, you'll stop in.
There you go.
Yes, sir.
What's going into that big hole in the ground now where all the other stores were?
Well, currently the diagram has a similar building that was existing before the fire. One difference is it's a two-story with a full basement that will be rented out. So there are, in essence, three stories, one underground. I believe that the anchor is going to be a TD Bank, and the rest will be commercial and office space.
Okay. All right. Well, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much, Manny.
Thank you, absolutely. This has been wonderful. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for letting me be part of your show.
Well,
right.
Dan was a guest at one of the earlier shows. And in the words of Met Radio announcer Howie Rose after Met Win, put it in a book. Tune in next week for my discussion with writer and educator M.G. Lord. Until then, as we say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa. Whoa, steady, Silver, steady.